Right, so I'm really delighted to welcome Rhiannon Hooson here this evening. Rhiannon, last read at Ledbury, we think it was 2009, just after you won the Eric Gregory Awards.
A long time ago,
which I remember because I was very new to Ledbury at that time myself. And so Rhiannon was born in Mid Wales and now lives in Pristine, after time spent in the north of England and in Mongolia. And we have her collection, The Other City, here for sale. And that's the collection that I think you're going to read from, yes. Is it? And chat about. So that's what we'll hear from tonight. So please join me to welcome Rhiannon Hooson.
Thank you, Claire, for that introduction and for inviting me over. It's a beautiful day. I'm sorry you're all inside. I'd like to start with a poem about what I believe is a ritual peculiar to Wales, although I think it might have spread to the borders a little bit, where when someone dies, their family pays a sin eater to take on their sins before they get buried. So this poem is called The Sin Eater. After my great-grandfather's death, his wife brought in a sin eater. I like to think it had been raining that day, that he was weighed down with water as she watched his approach from her heavy curtained window. He must have walked up from the town a good half hour's journey. His step was light on the path, inaudible in the steady drive of rain. She would have made him wait on the step, his Sunday suit stiff with moisture, his hair slipping down his forehead. She had not bothered to stop the clocks, and in the dark hall they ticked to her time now. His coat stained the floor beneath the hat stand, and she pretended not to see, ushered him to a straight-backed chair brought in from the kitchen. She cooked the meal herself, served on the second-best china. The casket beneath the plate had an enviable shine, and I imagine him eating until the plate was clean, in small, deliberate mouthfuls, balanced on a heavy fork. I wonder what she cooked him, whether he liked it. I'm told he was a thin man, like a bird, as if food eaten over a corpse could never nourish him. Besides, she would not have given him anything rich, nothing so juicy as a steak, nothing meaty. My great-grandfather would not have warranted it. When I was growing up, I had a book of Greek myths, first that my dad read to me and then that I read myself. I was really obsessed with this book. I remember it had terrifying illustrations. And this is a poem about something that struck me as a child as quite strange. It's called Bulls. Zeus has a propensity for slipping his flesh into the shape of a bull, stretching his tough hide over its hulking frame. He's always at it. Witness the whip of Europa's hair as she rides him over the receding waves, sitting daintily side saddle on his broad back and wiping wind tears from her red cheeks. He did these things under the moon of precedent, though. Had Pasiphae not fallen for the bull that grazed at Gortyn, Zeus might have stuck with an eagle. Even the women are at it. Io trod 100 islands as a heifer before Zeus flicked his wrist and she grew breasts again. Best not to ask the fate of Ariadne, nor that of poor Asterius, her brother. And now I come to think of it, didn't I, as a child, first come to know of men while watching the white bull in the field behind the house? The snow was still patchy on the ground, and he, wreathed in his own steam, had the look of a god even then. I was thinking about the idea of truth and what truth is to poetry. Truth as a transitory thing, as a polyphonic thing. Many different things being true at once for a single instant, and then ceasing to be true. I found a fantastic website where people would post pictures from that particular day from all around the world and mark them with a timestamp. So you could look and see what was happening around the world at a particular time. And it varied from quite profound things to beautiful sunsets to I've just done some laundry. And this is a poem that I wrote about the truth. Facts, 8th of January. Today, the almond trees began to blossom in the streets on the edge of Jerusalem. Today, the mango rains fell in Salavan and the fruits began to ripen. In Washington, the air between trees was hazy with wood smoke and each pine branch was slicked down with ice, and in Helsinki, where the sky is the same lilac as the dress of a woman eating out in Padua, the sun set as children were leaving the schools. In Santa Clarita, the fountains froze. For the first time in 18 years, snow fell gently there. People pressed their fingertips to the windows, let their breath whisper the view, touched their lips so softly to the glass. Quite nice having a longer reading here. It lets me read a bit of a longer poem. So I've got a couple of poems that actually sort of touch on hair. I'm strangely fascinated by hair and how it's become a symbol of the feminine. The first poem is called How Women Are Not the Same. Remember, you were small enough once to sit in your grandmother's lap and stroke the dry crests of her curls. They had the softness of animals, of mice, of moths, the fur behind a cat's ear. When she died, it was a simple thing to see her hair tangling the rich earth, strands of it matted out and sprouting from the ground like pale and delicate grass. And remember too your mother laying out newspaper in the kitchen like altar cloths, placing a chair beneath the light with such precision, the smell of newspaper and your sister's shampoo. She left a salon once in tears, and since then only your mother could cut her hair. It would end up caught along the hedge for the birds to line their nests. There's an envelope in an upstairs drawer with a lock of hair, your name and your sister's name, the strands mixed, blonde and brown. You think of it growing there, unseen, the threads that slowly twine around the faded silks of your mother's underwear, tangling the whole drawer full with its soft mass and spilling down behind the dresser, under the floorboards. Weeks after your sister left home, her hair was in the carpets. By then, you are transfixed with the fine lick of hair against another girl's temple, with her tender hands, the eczema on her elbows, her white halter top that you tied up afterwards. The bow was wrong, but she kept it that way anyway. You remember her the first time I draped the length of my hair over both our heads to make a dark tent for kisses, when my hair grips your fist back. And you've woken, haven't you, with my hair in your mouth or wrapped around your throat, with the dull length of it wound around your limbs. It fills the bed and spreads through the dim house, knots itself with bindweed and ivy, finds the roots of the rhododendrons under the weak lying moon. Feel it resting softly now against your cheek, across your eyelids. This next poem is commissioned for anthology later, comes out later this year, so it's still on the it's about Frida Kahlo. I looked at her work for weeks and I was so inspired, certainly by her portraits, which have this amazing direct gaze. They look straight at the viewer out of the canvas. But the painting which really stayed with me was one called Two Nudes in a Forest, which is a picture of two women lying together. They also reappear in her painting What the Water Gave Me, so they're obviously quite significant. It's one of the only places where, in her work where she addresses her bisexuality, and it was a really powerful picture for me. tender but with a real sense of fierceness behind its protectiveness. And I found a note that said in her sketchbook she'd made notes about different colours and how she felt about them, what she thought of them. And next to the colour greenish-yellow, she had written, "All ghosts wear clothes of this colour." And I knew that was the title for my poem. Oops, I'm dropping poems. "All ghosts wear clothes of this colour. I loved you only in the garden women go to when they sleep. I loved you in clearings where leaves were layered and glossy as black wax, and our moon blue skin was all we danced in. Our hearts were pomegranates. Our hands were an offering to air. I had never opened my mouth until the nightjar opened its own. Only the monkeys had male eyes, their little hands bright with pollen, their tails curled and swaying. We wrote love across the dust with the stamp of our bare feet until only one sound remained, the beating heart of the hummingbird on your brow. But love, we are ghosts of ourselves. We danced our way out of the garden and we are lost, but tiredness cannot temper us. Love, put on your chartreuse dress. The world has hurt us. Let us cut off our hair and remake it." One of the ideas that I'm interested in, and I explore in this collection in quite a few poems, is the idea of undoing, of taking an action back, sort of unweaving reality and stepping back to an earlier stage. And because of this, I've ended up with quite a few backwards poems. Basically, I think you could say that I like playing around with entropy. And this is one of those poems. It's called Bat. "I watch the cat track finches across the thin crust of snow, trembled weight not piercing to the mud, and time slips backwards, spools back that slick of sight, the cat's stealth slinking, traceless and cowed from the laughing birds as winter thaws itself into autumn, trips back the leaves to their nodding boughs, has us walking to each dawn's dozing, steps neatly placed to erase our tracks. Let us take back our birthday presents, turn away from each other and back like magnets confused at our poles. Let time lead us into summer, your mother, her dress, its chintz against the freshening flowers where spring is caught in the year's throat. And already leaves grow back into the trees, and it becomes white again under our feet. The birds shrivel wetly, crawl baldly back to shells that slam shut over their heads. And the second turns inside out, and our hearts judder backwards. All this to watch you wake at dusk and walk towards me." Last Men. "Because they did not see the white moon in its descent. Because they did not hear the heron call, and in the night when soft things whispered feathered words, they turned their faces into muffled pillows. Because they never said their own names. Because in winter they wrapped up too well in the thin sun. Because they were healthy. Because the lamps were turned down low, because they spoke in vowels and used polished spoons, and because, when faced with fire, they thought of crumpets. Because they could list too many things and with too many words. Because they were strung with pearls and polished plastics, and when they dreamed of swimming or of flying. Because there was no forgiving, only restitution. Because they forgot how to sing and left soft hummed notes spilling from their pockets like wine gums. Because the sun was too close and the stars too far away. Because they crowded the hillsides like cattle or winter geese. Because they said only yes to life. Because they recycled. Because they did not recycle enough. because they knew too well how to love and loved everything until there were only smooth pebbles of things and the soft moon falling. I'd like to read the title poem next from my collection, The Other City. I find a statistic that said 90% of the time, roughly, when men go missing, it's of their own volition. It's not the case for women, obviously. But I was fascinated by this, and I wanted to know, where are they going? You know, what are they up to? So this is The Other City. Sometimes men go missing. Warm tarmac, the turn of the key, the smell of newly laid carpet too much. There are calls to be made, hours to be unfilled, letters written and discarded, whispered in the quiet, dry space of the car as rain falls, the arc of the wipers and their wordless hush. Perhaps the glass steams and slowly obscures everything, until only the smell of dry cleaning and last week's one cigarette remains. Only the radio tuned beneath the rain, the letters unwritten, the sudden precipice of the road, the measured tick of the indicator. Sometimes men go missing. They do not come back. Look for them in a drab city of brick, penned in by a summer's haze, streets sluiced with beer. See them always with their faces turned. See them throng the empty parade ground, cobbles smeared with the shadows of upright statues. See them tread a muddle of alleys leading nowhere. And in the spring, see them circle the bleached, clean skull of a horse, its brow stuck with smashed glass, which casts insects of light across their eyes, the bridges of their noses, their hard-skinned hands that move so gently. A couple of poems now about monstrous women. This next one is, it was written for an anthology where each poet wrote a poem based on an element in the periodic table. And my element was plutonium. The poem is about the names we give to dangerous things. It's called Fatale. This is the skin I wanted. I wanted to shed my silks. I wanted to be white as a fire beneath ice, wild as the spinning sun and grounded as granite, but I was better broken open, a thing ruined with starlight and towering fast. I was there when Piccinni sang her last song. There in the desert when the sand melted to slag, I flew with Enola. I was the long hunger stuck in gravity's throat. Call me Gilda, call me Lulu. Call me Bikini Helen. Show me smiling and riding the big bomb down. And I know it was a joke to you, a way to play at owning me, but a star fell upon the ocean and it had my name. This next one is, it was written as a sort of challenge to write a poem about an urban legend. And one of my favourite urban legends is Typhoid Mary, who was a real woman.
Oh, yeah.
She was a cook who really didn't believe that washing her hands would protect the people she cooked for from typhoid. It's quite a sad story because she got detained and put in quarantine on an island in the middle of the river in New York. And she was very cross about it, understandably so. But of course, the urban legend is that she was responsible for the deaths of thousands of people after knowingly spreading typhoid. So I decided to write from the point of view of this fictionalised, quite terrifying Mary. And I like the idea that typically feminine traits, like providing nourishment, would be turned into weapons, into instruments of divine justice in her mind. So this is Feeding the 5,000. That first year, the streets were thick with fog. God went through it like a man picking eggs from water glass and marked sickness on the brows of those who deserved sickness. And if my hand was his hand, then it was his hand, and what was not good was not well. A fever lay on the river, and I made peach ice cream, lobster salad, currant jelly the same gleaming scarlet as a bleeding heart. I was God's prayer. I lay on his tongue unspoken. Sickness narrows the soul to a point, but my soul was spreading. Even the river could not contain it. God says that plagues come as a punishment, but nourishment was my weapon, and I fattened the city on my wrath. I'm sure most of you know that Echo in Greek myth, we're back to that Greek myth book again, was a mountain nymph who was cursed to lose her voice and only be able to repeat words that were said to her. And she fell in love with Narcissus but couldn't tell him, so she had to watch him fall in love with himself. And eventually she wasted away until all that remained was her voice, long after he had gone. This is called Without Narcissus. The lack of his blindness shocks the silver water black. Your palms slap against its surface is looped silence. Bare shoulders with their heron stoop, wet ropes of your black hair, the empty water and the stiff-leafed lilies which break for sharp fingers, their pink throats silent and smiling, speak. Over the water, the red rock leans and watches. Your nails like fish scales break against the cool shadow of its noon, and the silence speak. Even the fish have voices, even the rough hush of the trees, even the birds. You press your body to the dark looned sediment and learn its silence. Touch the red heat of your mouth to the rock and learn the syllables of its unspeech. Speak. Birds watch you, writing the mangled sign of your name. Wet hair strung across the tangled mats of cress, white fingers and their fish belly pallor. Your lips kissed against the petals of the lilies. You can speak their silence back to them so well, so well. This is a poem about a Japanese scientist who I found a picture of and I thought was a fascinating man. His name is Uchikiro Nakaya and he worked for Hokkaido University in the 1930s. And he was a pioneer at cataloguing different types of water crystals, snowflakes basically. He took thousands and thousands of photographs of them and classified them into seven different types. And this poem is about him. It's called Origami. I can see you teaching this to an empty room. How you run the crease between finger and thumbnail. Turn the paper this way and that. The mountain fold turns your smile away, silver sketching the bones of your face, a napkin draped over a dish of plums. The valley fold is your cupped hands, silence of your absent thoughts, a cradled arm of logs that burn dustily, a dish of plums beneath the window, where snow falls and casts its quiet shadows, and beyond, the dark fringe of the wood, bowing its head like a black horse. There is this and little more, the house, the blanked out lawn, one street lamp and the torn edge of the wood. But the petal fold is a dream you had, and remembered years later, the barking of a dog on a summer night, a girl, and how your hand might fit the nape of her neck. I imagine the rabbit ear fold hears how cold might get inside you, grow whitely where there is no space to grow. It is a neat desk beneath a window, and how, asleep, you smile sometimes, and nod, and acquiesce. Over time, things become precise, and we reduce ourselves to this. a dish of winter plums, snow falling through the dim light of a single street lamp, the waiting of the wood and how it sees us. We work paper so we do not have to cover it with words. Here, a paper flower in a dish of water, on a small desk beneath a window where snow is always falling. This last one is the last poem in the book. I wrote it after I came back from Mongolia, and it was my first attempt at approaching writing about Mongolia. If your Mongolian is a little bit rusty, I will let you know what the Mongolian words in it mean. There's just two. Zud is a harsh winter, a really harsh winter, and Gur is the Mongolian word for yurt. It's called Daughters of the Dust. There can be no mermaids of the steppe, though its bare hills roll and boom like the sea. Only some stranger creature lithe in the gelid dust and furred like a fox. Silent, accusing in the eyes, a deep wind parting fur down to bone-coloured skin. Horizons pile, thin as paper, one atop the next, and they spin their story into the pinched air. A woman and a wish. And a Corsac fox. Knights of the great white Zood, they might dance away the snow, leaving paths of grass for the herd to eat, or else rise like walls to blow across the landscape, stately and slow and sickening, only the chiming ice singing their welcome with its spare high notes, each like the prick of a needle. And in the city, where the night smell of sweet smoke and milk and idling traffic, they go walking now. Silent over the glaze of blood, frozen to the ground around the wrestling palace. Silent in the alleys where stray dogs sleep in the warmth from sewer grates. Silent past the cafes where soldiers thaw their brows over salt milk tea. Silent until they are singing, each alone in the dim reaches of the night. Each pale as an unlit candle, up through the Gurs where the roads falter and the lights go out, up to the mountain where the wind sings back, towering and tidal and old. Thank you.
Thank you. That was wonderful. What a wonderful poem. That is.
It's a nice little picture.
I think actually I might ditch the plan and just ask about that poem, seeing as it's fresh in our heads.
Okay.
So I want to start with how it came to you. How did you begin that poem?
Well, while I was in Mongolia, I had a sort of strange thing happen to me in that I felt completely unable to write about Mongolia. So I wrote reams of stuff, but none of it was about Mongolia. And only when I returned, I started making little notes. And one of the first things I remember writing down was about the frozen blood on the pavement outside the wrestling palace. Which they seemed very cheerful about the fighting. It was all very sort of camaraderie, really. But this really struck me as a thing peculiar to Mongolia. So there were lots of little glimpses into my stay there that stuck with me. But what I didn't want to do was to write about it with any sense of ownership, because obviously, although I live there, I'm not Mongolian. So one of the ways I thought of that would let me approach it in what I hoped would be a sensitive way was to make up my own mythology, to mythologise my own experience there. So the sort of mythological figures in the poem, they're not from Mongolian mythology, they're my creation. A way of sort of approaching the landscape there.
Yeah. It's that really interesting opening where you say there are no mermaids, and then you've got this landscape which is this big open landscape, and then this, and then the wind is like a character in it as well,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So these creatures are your idea of what a Mongolian...
I suppose so, yeah. Really, yes.
Yeah.
One of the things I remember most strongly from when I arrived, as the plane was sort of getting lower and lower, I looked out of the window and it was just the steppe underneath, and every now and again you could see a fire from, because obviously most Mongolians are still nomadic, of a camp in the steppe, and it did look like the sea. It's a bit of a cliche that the steppe looks like the sea, but it really did. And so that got me thinking a mythology of the of this grass sea. Well, not mermaids, but...
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. And they have this kind of foxy... You've got the Corsac fox.
The Corsac fox.
But it's... And this idea of what they do, how they travel around, it gives you the opportunity to have this sweeping thing. You've taken a lot, don't you, through their eyes.
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I loved so much about Mongolia was the fact that everything seemed massive. Starting with, obviously, the Soviet architecture, everything is a palace, like the wrestling palace. And you have these gigantic spaces that they've done in their city planning to the mountains and the steppe. Because there's so little moisture in the air, everything seems really up close to you. And it does seem as though you're existing in this really stately, mythological almost environment, where things are not quite the same as they are in Britain.
So did it come quite easily formed, or did it take? How did it sort of develop from the original?
It went through many, many different forms.
Yeah.
In fact, what I often find with my poetry is that I'll start with a draft and I'll leave it and work on it and come back a month later and do the same thing. But it's often not until I combine two poems, and see how they combine that the poem comes together. It happened with this poem. Originally, I had the woman and the Corsac fox. Something mythological happening there, but it wasn't really tied to my Mongolian experience. It wasn't until I combined those two things that the poem really came together. The same thing happened actually with another poem I read towards the end, Origami. It started as two poems as well. Obviously the origami folding and the names of the different folds was a separate poem. And then through seeing photographs of this scientist in his isolated cabin in the snow, wondering what he was like with his students, and maybe he would teach them origami folds in his spare time. That's how it sort of came together for me to rationalise the progression through these seven stanzas, like the seven different types of crystals. So.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's really interesting, because when I was listening to that poem, I had the Louis MacNeice poem come into my head because of the snow falling through the window, and I thought it was lovely to take origami and make it into a snowflake. Was that in your mind, that poem at all?
No, but it does fit right.
But it's interesting, that thing about randomness.
Yes.
Because I think that is that can be really very...
Definitely.
Powerful, can't it, to kind of... But how do you know when you're doing it, you've got the right... It's just a gut thing.
It is. I think a lot of poetry is chance, actually.
Yeah.
Just things that you happen upon, or you may have your poem, but you're not quite sure what the crux of it is, or you need another image, and stumbling across something random is often what does it. Which I think is the lovely thing about poetry. It leaves so much room for chance, and... because it's such a short form, usually, you can explore it.
Mm. And so do you quite like it when you ask to write a commissioned poem?
I do, actually.
Because it opens you...
Not only does it give me a deadline to work to, which I need from time to time, but I'm involved with a press based in Germany, Beautiful Dragons Press, and they bring out collaborative anthologies. So... I think perhaps four poems from my collection were originally done as a little nudge. The Plutonium poem was one of those, and I've got some more in there as well. Mm. And I find that it's great to have a starting point to work from. Very often I'll write three poems and two of them don't fit the anthology, but hey, I've got three poems.
Mm.
So I do quite like the idea of a commission. Often it's not what I would write about, which is another nice thing. Yeah. You get the chance to write about something that you wouldn't have thought about otherwise.
Mm. Yes, takes you out of your kind of zone of
comfort,
which is... Yeah. And puts you in mind a bit of something I was thinking about when... we had a workshop with Deryn Rees-Jones, the poet, on Monday, and she was talking about how she's wading through this book that she's trying to get to grips with at the moment. I thought that was such a... She said, I'm wading around in it, she said, that feeling of... And I thought, that's such an interesting way to think about reading poetry and writing. And so I just thought I'd throw that at you as a...
It's a lovely image, actually, and actually quite apt. When I was writing The Other City, I wrote it during a creative writing PhD, which was fantastic because it gave me a good 4 years to think about my process, my poetry, what I would like to do when constructing a collection. Obviously, there's a thesis to go with it, so think about that, which was a real privilege to just take the time to do that. But you do get mired in your own thought process when you have that time. And certainly for me, there was a lot of wading, while I was writing this. Wading in someone else's poetry, now that's much more of a pleasure, yes. I think.
Isn't it? In fact, maybe it's necessary with the writing. I don't know whether people here would agree with that, but maybe it's necessary with both the reading and the writing, that you have to be... prepared to do a certain amount of wading around.
I think so, yes. Especially, I don't know. For me, my process involves a lot of just hard grind editing, working on it over and over and over again, which is fine by me, but it's certainly not a kind of it's not all spontaneous.
So I thought I'd ask about The Other City, the title, because partly because, and it's nice because you read the poem, can sort of think about that poem again, because I don't know whether people felt the poem was, when Rhiannon was introducing it and saying about lots of men disappear, whether the poem you then heard was what you might have expected from that introduction. I don't know.
Possibly not.
That's it, yeah. So do you want to talk a bit about perhaps the poem and maybe, because this title has lived with you a long time, hasn't it?
It really has. The title predates that poem, actually. When I was thinking in great depth about my creative process, which is this fancy title that we give to how we write a poem, I started to picture it as a physical journey, a space that you move through physically. And the more I thought about that, the more I thought it might make a really interesting thing to explore. And in fact, I did end up exploring that for quite a few years for this collection. The idea that this space is fundamentally foreign to us as writers, but we traverse it and it affects us. We come out at the other end different to how we go in at the beginning. Whether you rationalise that as taking on the poetic eye, or whether you just think of it as an interesting journey of writing each individual poem, I suspect would be different for everybody. But for me, the idea of this space, this foreign space that affected me, was a fascinating one. And it happened to be, for me, a city. Whether that's because I've grown up in the countryside, I'm not sure. But the idea of a city which sort of occupies the same space that we do and now and again just shows itself in something familiar but unnerving and other. So the idea of these men, once they've left where we know of them, where do they go? And perhaps they go into this other space, where there are rituals that might seem sort of familiar to us but are unnerving. I have quite a few poems in my book where the space or a particular time of the year is described through ritual, because I think we do have rituals, like it's a beautiful spring day and we like to mark that by paying attention to the birdsong, or look, the daffodils are out, or you were talking about wassailing as well. Well, what are the rituals and the little sort of noticeable moments in this other space, and how do they differ? In fact, I've got a little poem that I might read that illustrates that. It's called In Spring, and it's just a little moment about what spring happenings are there in the other city, in this strange city. In spring, there are leaves like hands opening, and the old queen in her rotten palanquin teetering along the road. Stones in the black ground opening like eyes. You open your mouth to sing. The road bursts into blossom. Ticks fall from the backs of horses, nests from the eaves. In attic rooms fanfared with creaking ropes, poets hanging quietly sift into insects, find cracks, escape and burrow into the bronze shock of the sky. Those pinkly newborn children uncurl on their pillows and speak new words to their mothers, new soft words from their soft palates, and soak up sun on all the windowsills like fat, hairless cats watching. What gods come stalking on all fours, lean and hungry and afraid. So, it's
wonderful,
a strange
wonderful,
sort of
but I like the strangeness. Yeah. I mean, this and that, and this, it's a, there is a sort, it's a sort of, it's, I mean, it's a bit Shakespearean. I thought the
it
Queen on a Palanquin.
Yes,
it's lovely.
Yes,
I mean, it's a wonderful, and it's, I think it is the way that. So, thinking of the other city poem, that idea of these men circling, and then this violence at the centre of it, which is the horse's head with the sort of glass, but we don't know who's done that, and they're circling it, and then you talk about their tender hands, and it just undoes what you might, you know, expect from this idea of a city, and I just love that. I think.
Thank you. I'm really inspired, actually, by the idea that there is this space that poets can enter, and the rules of reality don't function quite the same way. And so I suppose that's touched on in the poems where everything goes backwards, where things are undone, or the idea of time speeding up and everything sifting to dust and a more empty space.
Yeah, that comes across in, there's lots of poems which have mirrors.
Yes.
That are a lovely sort of idea of this, of space between worlds
and
doors, yes, and doors and houses that are sort of falling apart.
Yes.
And these come through in the book over and over.
Yes.
And
yes.
Is that something that you sort of deliberately did, or did do you think that kind of emerged and became, because it does have a lovely musical sense then when you start to hear these and or read these, you know.
It was deliberate up to a point, as I think anything is. But I like the idea of if the reader decides to start from the beginning and read through the book poem by poem, which I don't think happens often, but if you do, there are little signs of the other city coming through gradually, and just little clues that you get in an otherwise, let's say, real world poem, that there's still another dimension to it, that there's something extra, something more behind it. And so I used mirrors and the idea of reflections and twinning. I use, well, what you could call a poetic binary, I and you, a lot in my poems, because I like playing with it and subverting it. So the you in my poems is always kind of a fluid thing. And I think the mirrors, the doorways, moving from one space into another is all part of that.
But yes, it's certainly true that when the first poems particularly are very rooted, actually, within a Welsh...
Yes,
you know,
definitely.
And really, you know, strong for that. I mean, the Sin Eater that we heard at the beginning. I'd love to know how that sort of you how you first heard that this was had happened, how this story is in the mythology of your family.
Right, yes.
It is your family, or
it is, yes. Right. Yeah. Someone who appears in my book quite a few times is my gran. When I was writing it over a period of quite a few years, she had dementia. And there was something about the way that she lost language that really struck me. And a lot of her stories, there's another story later on about meeting her brother for the first time. She hadn't seen him in many, many years, but both of them were much too stiff upper lip to say anything. So he delivered her mail and walked off, and that was it. So she had these great stories. And the Sin Eater, I think, is a way of recording that, apart from anything else. And it's just a lovely little vignette of strange Welshness. So that's where that came from. And there are lots of poems through the book which deal with... I think there's a certain sort of otherness that comes from illness. And there are a few poems that deal with that and how it relates to language and writing.
And silence that is there as a sort of... Because I get some, there are some poems that seem to deal with a kind of struggle of speaking linked also to that struggle to write that, you know, is...
Well, when I went to Mongolia, I was moving from a life centred around language, where I was a poet and I worked at university, and my life was language, to a country where I didn't speak the language, and basically no one really spoke English. So it felt very much like a kind of conscious relinquishing of language. Which, I won't lie, it was quite difficult. but it definitely had an effect on me, and I think that's where the idea of silence, not just being the absence of speech or the absence of sound, but some separate thing waiting at the end for you when language is being lost, kind of struck me. And I think it does crop up in the poems. The penultimate poem in the book, Leaving, I didn't read it tonight actually, which perhaps I should have, is about that feeling of dismantling language and packing up the world behind you as you leave, which I did feel a little bit like I was doing when I moved away. So that's what that poem came out of.
Yes, you get a sense, and I don't know if it's true to you, that leaving was a great home sort of wrench.
Or there it was a, yes.
Yeah, and yeah, to write definitely. About home, a sort of homesickness quite strongly, which I really felt was a powerful thing to...
Well, we have a word for it in Welsh, hiraeth,
okay,
which is a kind of powerful nostalgia and yearning for a home that isn't there anymore. So I think there's a thread of that going through the work, definitely.
Yeah.
Even now I've come back.
Yes, exactly. Does anyone else want to ask anything? Has anyone got anything that they thought?
I just wanted to ask you why you chose Mongolia. I understand about how when you go and live, I spend a lot of time in Greece with Greek people.
Right.
And I don't speak much Greek.
It's a difficult
and
thing to do,
isn't
it?
You separate yourself off, but it also made me...
I have a great affinity for icy wastelands. Mongolia was something that had always appealed to me, and when I was coming towards the end of my PhD, I felt that I really needed a break, something to shake up my system, a complete change, and that came to me. I just decided, that's it, I'm going to go to Mongolia. And when I was there, what you're saying about it makes you silent, it's kind of an enforced silence, is absolutely right. I ended up miming a lot and making a bit of a fool of myself. And when I say no one really speaks English, there are a few people, obviously, who speak English and... or little bits of English, and they're thrilled to chat with someone. But I think you have to sort of throw yourself in at the deep end and try and learn what you can. But for me, being in a country where I couldn't use my language freely, was a strange, but well, it made a lasting impression on me.
How long were you there for?
About 18 months.
Long enough to really sort of immerse yourself in it as much as you could without the language.
I mean, the weather is a great, I mean, theme through you, but
it is,
and
yes.
Floods.
Right, yes, yes. When I lived up in Cumbria before I went to Mongolia, there was one particular winter that made a real impression on me, and I can remember lying in bed at night. It was just after Christmas. And we had a long driveway up to our house, hearing the trees falling over the driveway one by one. And it was the most apocalyptic storm. And I came out the next morning and couldn't get out because there were 14 trees. And Cumbria was very badly affected by this storm, and there were massive floods. And after it had sort of abated, I remember driving out and there were sheep in the tops of the trees, because the flooding had, and they were just dead and strung up there. And it was a really apocalyptic landscape that left a real impression on me, as you can imagine. And the idea as well of flooding being, it seemed caught up intrinsically with my childhood. I grew up around rivers a lot. I have a poem about damming this river one day. And it's just something that stuck with me, really.
Where did you stay in Mongolia?
I lived in Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital city. Mm-hmm. I had a flat in an old Soviet tower block, which was not as warm as the yurts, but the yurts come right into the city and you get them around the bottom of these high-rise blocks. And they're actually really beautiful. My flat was not. But it was an amazing city to live in.
Gosh, so people are living in the yurts?
Yes, in the city.
In the city, in within the flats and within the built-up parts.
Around the bottom. Yes, yeah. As far as I'm aware, about two-thirds of the people who live in the city still live in these traditional gur. They have amazing painted doorways. They're very beautiful.
Funny how we say yurt. Why do we say yurt when it's a girl?
Well, yurt is the Russian word for it, I think.
Is it?
And more people have heard that, so I sort of slip into saying that, but in Mongolia they are girls.
And do Russians use yurts, and is that why? Or do they
I suppose in Siberia, the nomadic people there. I mean, there's a lot of overlap between the two peoples, because obviously the border is an arbitrary one.
Any other questions?
I was wondering what you were exploring with your PhD.
Well, I did my PhD in poetry. So while I was writing this, I was writing a thesis about my creative process and I suppose a more academic exploration of the other city and what that process is to me and locating it, I guess, within the literary canon.
Shall we finish then with leaving the poem that you thought you, you know, because that was, I think that is, that would bring together some of the things we've just talked about and be a nice way, I think, finish on a poem, I think. Does everyone agree? It's nice to finish with. So it'd be lovely to hear.
Leaving. There was no road for us. And the lake beds with their smooth mud were like eyes closing. Yes, we drained them one by one behind us, and we tore up the hedges, and we kicked at the limestone walls until they toppled. We walked on with our pockets filled with words, little papery things which we traded at night around the last fires, and shuffled, and remembered, and forgot. Tea, we told each other. Siren, mother. By then the leaves were turning and the trees were lifted from their drab. We remembered them also and burnt them whole, great torches flaring up against the deepening cloud. The hills eventually turned to dust. Squat cottages slumped into scree and the tough sheep wintered into fleece and bones. We turned our back on rain and honey, 100 years of home. When the fog fell onto us, we raised our faces and walked on with empty pockets, hoping to happen upon new vocabularies. But until then, until the day when the fog lifts and we remember a new place, how can I hold all this in the palm of my heart?
Thank you.